Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeffrey Fawcett. We come to you every week with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health in the environment. The popular use of vitamin supplementation is regularly attacked in the conventional media. Take the recent article about the uselessness of multivitamins. What are these reports based on? Is it credible research? Not according to today's guest, Dr. Balls Fry, director of the Linus Pauling Institute. It may not surprise you that vitamins are studied using the same methods as testing pharmaceuticals. In an article last year in the journal Nutrients, he wrote the article Myths, Artifacts, and Fatal Flaws with Alexander Michaels. And that in that paper, they unpack study approaches used in research on vitamin C that can lead to incorrect conclusions about its actions. Mammal physiology is very complex. There are numerous pathways and cascades involved in the metabolism and actions of nutrients. As well, each body, human or other, is unique. Creating a cell culture in a dish is fraught with unintended consequences, and so is working in a living body. So many questions that should have been answered before starting are ignored. Join us this hour as we explore how these precious nutrients can effectively be studied and what new things have already been revealed about when and how to use them. I'm joined today to do a show that I'm calling Flawed Vitamin Research by Dr. Balls Fry, B-A-L-Z-F-R-E-I, Balls Fry. He's a distinguished professor of biochemistry and biophysics and director and endowed chair of the Linus Pauling Institute at Oregon State University at Corvallis, Oregon. Dr. Fry's research interests include the role of vitamins, micronutrients, and other dietary factors in promoting optimal health and preventing disease, in particular atherosclerosis and heart disease, the role of oxidative stress and inflammation in human health and disease, and the health benefits of dietary supplements. He has made important contributions to our understanding of the biological mechanisms and health effects of vitamin C and E, coenzyme Q10, lipoic acid, and flavonoids. Dr. Fry has published over 200 scientific papers that have been cited over 20,000 times by his peers. His research has been continuously funded since 1993 with grants from the National Institutes of Health, and he has received numerous awards. Dr. Fry studied at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland, where he received his doctorate in biochemistry. He completed postdoctorate fellowship at the University of California, Berkeley, with Dr. Bruce N. Ames, and then as was an assistant and an assistant professor, respectively, at Harvard School of Public Health in Boston University School of Medicine. He joined the Linus Pauling Institute as director and endowed chair in 1997, and now he's joining us, and we're very pleased to have you. Welcome, Dr. Fry.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Oh, I'm really excited to talk to you. I found the paper quite remarkable, partially because it reminded me of the incredible complexities of how we utilize substances, particularly micronutrients, in our bodies. How many different things have to take place, and what, and that it isn't a you don't know always in each given situation what's going to happen. So,
right.
I'm also, you know, I'm under the impression that vitamin research has been going on certainly since the mid 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
Is that so?
Yes, obviously, you know, there has been a lot of interest in vitamins for a long time. I think the way we look at vitamins has changed somewhat over time. You know, initially we had the deficiency diseases that pointed to the absolutely critical role of these vitamins in the prevention of these deficiency diseases. For example, you know, vitamin C deficiency causes scurvy, which killed hundreds of thousands of sailors in the 18th and 17th century, and that cause of that was eventually uncovered by James Lind, who was a surgeon, a British surgeon, And he simply found that giving the sailors orange juice or lime juice could completely prevent scurvy and cure scurvy. So initially, the way these vitamins were discovered was through their deficiency diseases. And now the focus is more on the role of these vitamins potentially in also helping to lower the risk of chronic diseases.
Yeah,
it's quite
indeed.
Different from their actual biological functions in the body.
Now, you chose vitamin C to cover in this article, and it is an extensive article. It's very conclusive.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good. Why did you choose vitamin C particularly? Is it because there's so many assumptions about how it works and so many mistakes about the way it's studied?
Yes, that's certainly part of the reason. It's also, you know, because of Linus Pauling, the most talked about and most popular dietary supplement. And there have been many, many studies on vitamin C that are seriously flawed, and so we chose that as an example to point out all these issues in general with vitamin research as it is applied to humans in particular.
So before we unpack your study about what's wrong with the way vitamin research is conducted, why don't you give people some idea of what you have come to learn about the benefits of vitamin C, because they're not exactly the same as the ones that people assume.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are the known biological functions of vitamin C in a number of enzyme reactions. And vitamin C, also called ascorbic acid, basically acts as a cofactor or a co-substrate in these enzyme reactions. For example, the synthesis of collagen, excuse me, which is the substance that, you know, forms the glue in our tissues and holds the cells together and the bones and all the other tissues, the collagen synthesis requires vitamin C. And if you don't have enough vitamin C, your collagen synthesis is impaired and as a consequence to develop the signs of scurvy. So your teeth are falling out, your wounds are not healing, all these important processes that require normal collagen function will be impaired. There are other important known biological functions of vitamin C. One of them is in the synthesis of a compound called carnitine. Now, carnitine is very important for turning fat into energy because the fat needs to get into mitochondria in our cells, and the mitochondria are the power plants in your cells. So vitamin C makes a molecule that helps fat get into mitochondria for energy production. And if you don't have enough vitamin C, you cannot burn your fat efficiently in your mitochondria, and therefore you have less energy. And indeed, an early sign of vitamin C deficiency before you develop the classical symptoms of scurvy is lassitude and fatigue. And this is because you don't burn your fat as efficiently as you would in the presence of adequate amounts of vitamin C. And then there are some other functions in neurotransmitter synthesis, all known, you know, functions of vitamin C related to its enzyme functions. But then what I have been doing a lot of work on is the antioxidant function of vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really separate from the function it has in collagen synthesis or carnitine synthesis. Vitamin C is a very strong antioxidant. What does that mean? Well, it can prevent the oxidation of different molecules in your body, in particular protein, DNA, and fat can all get oxidized. Like if fat goes rancid, that is an oxidation process. And if that happens in your arteries, that can contribute to atherosclerosis and heart disease. If your DNA becomes oxidized, then it causes mutations and potentially start cancer. And so the idea is there that vitamin C, acting as a strong antioxidant, can prevent these oxidation processes from happening and therefore can lower your risk of heart disease or certain types of cancer. And so this is kind of the new research now that focuses more on the functions of vitamins, or here in particular vitamin C, that are separate from the functions it has in preventing deficiency disease.
You know, I want to really get into how you did your paper, because it's fascinating window into how vitamin research is done and why it's a problem, mm-hmm. why these sensationalistic articles that appear in the paper that warn us off of vitamins are so silly.
Yeah.
Aside from the fact that when you look at the reports on deaths from toxic substances, there are no deaths from taking vitamins. I think last year there was one person who is reported to have died from something happening with a vitamin, but we don't know the details of that. It's just
right.
a report.
Yeah.
One, and if you compare that to anything else, you know, it's
yeah.
really remarkable. Anyway,
yeah.
In the end of your article, although you are somehow, you know, still the spawn of Linus Pauling, at least, you know, the heir of his work,
mm-hmm.
he was advocating very large doses of vitamin
yeah.
C. He believed very strongly in it. And at the end of your article, you say something that actually made me kind of, I thought, wait a minute, I've been advocating for years that people replete their dose of vitamin C
mm-hmm.
At least twice a day. That they try for maybe 1,000 twice a day. And you're saying no, you know, really. If you look at how the body utilizes C and what happens once the body's repleted, it has enough vitamin C,
mm-hmm.
that it really only takes about 200 milligrams to keep that status, that vitamin C status, unless, of course, there are other mitigating circumstances. Vitamin C is very protective to the gut. You know, there are other groups of people with particular types of sensitivities or proclivities who would be
right.
needing more vitamin C, particularly
yeah.
people who are poor and undernourished.
Right.
But you say that it isn't necessary to take it more than once a day, and that really threw me for a loop, because I thought that, especially under stress and with our oxidative stress being breathing animals, that we... that the vitamin C does its job and then isn't able to help out as well later on, so that you need to take it more than once a day. You're saying no?
Well, so, yes, vitamin C is highly regulated. Linus Pauling took 18 grams a day, but we have now done, or not necessarily we, people at the NIH, Mark Levine and his colleagues at the National Institutes of Health, have done a lot of pharmacokinetic studies on vitamin C. And from that, we know that you really cannot absorb much more than 200 to maybe 400 milligrams of vitamin C a day. And once you are repleted, once your tissues are saturated with vitamin C, you can't really take up more than what's already in your body. Plus, any excess that's still making it into your body will be excreted in the urine. All of this is to say that vitamin C metabolism is very tightly regulated, both at the level of absorption and at the level of tissue distribution, and then eventually at the level of excretion from your body. So if you take 18 grams in a single dose, and this is a person who is already saturated with vitamin C, very little of that 18-gram dose is being absorbed into the body and into the tissues. And what is absorbed and circulates in the blood, most of that is excreted again, because you have a urinary threshold and you can't exceed a certain concentration of vitamin C in your bloodstream.
Yeah, I understand. Let me just let people know again that you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett is sitting by me, and we are on the phone with Balz, B-A-L-Z, Frei, F-R-E-I, from the Linus Pauling Institute. He is a biochemist and biophysicist and director of Linus Pauling Institute, and he's a professor. And we're discussing the flaws in vitamin research, and we took a little side path to talk about vitamin C.
Can I add just quickly, you said that, you know, with all the oxidative stress and all
yes.
other challenges that we're facing, the vitamin requirements, especially vitamin C requirements, because it is an antioxidant, may be higher.
That's right.
depending on inter-individual differences. You mentioned that in your introduction, there are big differences from one individual to the next. In different life stages, you may have increased needs for vitamin C. Older adults, we know, need more vitamin C to become saturated. People who smoke, people who are suffering from infectious diseases, have inflammatory conditions.
And cancer.
And cancer, of course. All of these individuals consume vitamin C or use it up much more rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you need to replete it with larger doses and more often. So, you know, when I'm saying that 200 milligrams is enough, you're talking about a completely healthy individual, kind of what the RDA, you know, the recommended dietary allowance, talks about. This is not for people with certain conditions. This is supposedly the minimum requirement for healthy people to maintain saturation of vitamin C in their bodies.
Well, and I will confess to being an advocate of mega vitamin dosing, and I have read lots of research about why that might be a good idea. And I don't like one of the ways that vitamin supplementation gets attacked is the expensive urine argument.
Yeah.
And the problem with that argument is that no pharmaceutical would work.
Yeah.
If we were really urinating everything out and nothing was working. And it's very important what you said, which is that, you know, I don't know anybody who is a completely healthy person. I mean, there are people whose diet is so rich in fruits and vegetables and good, you know, eat lots of tomatoes and things like that. And so they're getting vitamin C in their food, and they're not under stress. But I don't know those people. So, but, you know, I do remember a very interesting study, which I should have gotten my hands on to cite for you, but I will tell you it, and it may be familiar to you. There was a study where supposedly they took a number of firefighters, and before they left to go fight a fire, they infused them with 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C. And then when they came back, they checked their levels after they were in this very stressful situation, hot and cold and hot and cold and really stressful.
Yeah.
And there was no measurable amount of vitamin C left. Now, there's problems there, as we'll discover as we go now into what's wrong with all these methods of testing. But that seems to speak to the idea that if you're under stress, and who isn't these days, taking vitamin C in higher doses than 200 and repleting it a couple times a day might just be really inexpensive insurance.
No, I totally agree with that.
Oh, good.
Yeah, no, and, you know, the whole argument of expensive urine, I think, is ridiculous, because vitamins, if you're talking about vitamins and minerals, they're not expensive at all compared to any pharmaceutical drug. Vitamins are dirt cheap, so the argument that you are wasting money, to me, is completely bogus. I do agree absolutely that if you're under increased oxidative stress or increased stress in general, again, your vitamin C requirements will be much higher. You know, I've looked at vitamin C levels in many different patient groups, and I was amazed that in patients with adult respiratory distress syndrome who have massive infection and sepsis, there is absolutely no detectable vitamin C in their plasma.
Wow.
Similar to what you're describing here to these firefighters.
Oh.
And most of these people end up, you know, dying of sepsis, but it was amazing that that group of subjects, of patients, had absolutely no detectable vitamin C levels. And then you see in others, like smokers and often overweight or obese people, older adults, they also have lower plasma vitamin C levels. So clearly, depending on your life stage and your personal health status, you will have a higher requirement of vitamin C just to maintain normal healthy levels. People in hospitals in particular, they are often deficient or inadequate in many vitamins and minerals because they are not paying attention to this and they're already under increased stress. You know, being in the hospital undergoing surgery will cause depletion of many of your vitamins and minerals, and then they're not being repleted by giving these subjects multivitamins and feeding them a healthy diet. So, you know, that's kind of a double whammy. You're already under increased stress and all the surgical and every other condition that you're exposed to, and then in addition to that, you're not getting adequate nutrition or adequate micronutrients. So that's a big issue, I think.
Are you saying that lime Jell-O is not nutritious?
No, not exactly.
No. Oh, I'm shocked.
Yeah.
The The other thing I know about, of course, and you know about too, is that there are physicians who are starting to use IV intravenous therapies using vitamin C for cancer, but also for, you know, there are people studying this. I think Thomas Levy is one of various people about using IV vitamin C instead of antibiotics, and sometimes it works.
Oh, yeah.
So, okay. So, the other last thing was that there is a misconception about, there are many misconceptions about vitamin C, like load up when you have a cold, you know, although that is a stress. But the main one is that the vitamin research says, oh, well, look, you know, you take a small amount of vitamin C, you give somebody 50 milligrams of vitamin C, and then it gets damaged because it gives up its electrons because it's an antioxidant. And then you have a damaged reactive oxygen species. You have this damaged molecule in there. And you said, well, it does get a little damaged, but it's not serious at all.
So it gets oxidized. When it acts as an antioxidant, that means it gives away electrons. And so ascorbic acid becomes oxidized to what we call dehydroascorbic acid. Now, the hydroascorbic acid, the oxidized form of vitamin C, in the body actually gets very effectively and efficiently recycled to the normal reduced form of vitamin C. There are enzymes that can do that, one called this thyroxine reductase, and then there is glutathione, which is another strong antioxidant in our body that we actually can synthesize.
In the liver, which we don't. We don't synthesize C, so...
That's right. We don't synthesize C, and that's why it's a vitamin. We need it from our diet. But glutathione we synthesize in the liver, and that can reduce the oxidized form of vitamin C back to its reduced form. So there's either recycling very quickly. The vitamin C is recycled from its oxidized form. If that doesn't happen, then the oxidized form of vitamin C actually very quickly decomposes. It has a half-life of a few minutes, which means after about 5 minutes, half of your oxidized vitamin C is already gone and forms a number of breakdown products, one of them being oxalic acid, and that's why some people argue that vitamin C may increase the risk of kidney stones because oxalic acid or oxalate is an important component of kidney stones.
And do you think it causes kidney stones?
No, I don't think so. I don't think the contribution of vitamin C is sufficient to increase the risk of kidney stones. People who have had a kidney stone before, who are prone to kidney stones, may want to avoid mega doses of vitamin C, but I think in the general population and consuming just average amounts of vitamin C, it doesn't contribute to kidney stones.
You should give out the website... for the Linus Pauling Institute, because if you have kidney stones, you can go and look up what sort of what research on vitamins has proven effective for prevention and treatment of kidney stones, among other things.
Yeah.
So it's I use the website all the time, although I haven't got it memorized. Have you got it memorized?
Yeah. Well, it's very simple. It's lpi.oregonstate.edu. lpi.oregonstate.edu.
Yeah.
And then we have on that website another website that's called Micronutrient Information Center. And if you go to the Micronutrient Information Center, you get information on all the vitamins and minerals and other dietary supplements and some foods and beverages. And we're describing fairly great detail what these vitamins and minerals are doing in your body, how they affect your health, how they might be useful in prevention or even treatment of certain diseases. We talk about dietary sources and then our recommendations at the end of each chapter.
Now, I want to reiterate something that people may or may not have actually heard Dr. Fry say, which is that although the body will saturate at 200 milligrams supplementation a day, that doesn't mean that taking it more frequently and in higher doses might not be protective, which is part of the reason we take vitamins, is to protect ourselves so that we have some margin, and that there are many conditions. You know, for instance, people sometimes are constipated, and if you add two servings of vitamin C at 1,000 milligrams or 800 milligrams a day, that usually abates.
Yeah.
So stuff like that. Anyway, and then...
Yeah, no, that's an important point, especially, you know, if you're thinking about the gastrointestinal tract, of course, if you take large gram doses, again, most of it just passes through and is not being absorbed. But you have the 18 grams going through your GI tract, and that in and of itself can have protective effects. And in fact, with respect to cancer, there is quite a lot of evidence that vitamin C can protect against different cancers in your GI tract, esophagus and then stomach and maybe even colon cancer. So you have different parts of your GI tract that are protected from vitamin C as it passes through.
Mm-hmm.
Although, again, a lot of it may not be absorbed into the circulation, you do have it in your body for a certain time.
Well, and most people don't, to do what we might call a vitamin C flush, which I find rather uncomfortable myself, you don't need 18 grams. Most people don't, you know, if you took, one thing I did once was I ate something that I'm highly allergic to. I'm very, very sensitive to dairy, and without realizing it, I consumed something with dairy, and I went home and I took 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any gastrointestinal symptoms, which to me means... that it counterbalanced, it somehow stopped the reaction.
Yeah.
So it was quite amazing. You know, it was a highly stressful situation, and I didn't have a bad effect from it. So I would say if you wanted to do a flush, 10,000 or 10, 10 grams would be sufficient.
There's the tolerable upper intake level.
Bowel tolerance,
The bowel tolerance. So the Institute of Medicine that comes up with the recommended dietary allowance and all the other dietary reference intakes also has a tolerable upper intake level, or UL. Now, for vitamin C, that's 2,000 milligrams because they argue that some individuals may experience gastrointestinal disturbances if they take more than 2 grams a day.
Some people do, some people don't. It depends on how much they need.
Exactly right. Yeah. But you know, what was amazing to me, when they were trying to find some adverse effects of vitamin C, this was the only one that they could come up with to justify a tolerable intake level.
So, it makes you gassy.
Yeah, exactly. But which tells you, even if you take 20 grams or more, there are no adverse effects. And that's often what the medical community argues. Well, these vitamins in very high doses are dangerous. Well, maybe for one or two specific vitamins that may be true, but... for vitamin C, if you take gram doses, there's certainly no adverse effects, and most likely you get a lot of benefits out of it.
And lastly, you don't have to spend a lot of money on vitamin C, because ascorbic acid, the most simple form of it, is just fine. But people sometimes like the calcium ascorbate or the sodium ascorbate because it is a little easier.
Sure.
So it's basic. So is there any disadvantage to taking calcium? Well, calcium, then you've got to figure in how much calcium, extra calcium you're taking, because calcium needs to be... not above a certain amount. And then sodium ascorbate, any thoughts, any reason not to use it?
Yeah, well, sodium is not necessarily what you want, but it's such a small amount compared to, the gram doses of sodium you eat every day from your other diet. It doesn't make a big contribution. So it doesn't really make a difference. I think if you are concerned about acidity, take any of those sodium or other mineral salts of life. By the way, we do have a fairly extensive chapter on our Micronutrient Information Center that specifically talks about different forms of vitamin C.
So the website again is?
That's the Micronutrient Information
Center. Yeah, LPI.
No, it's just lpi.oregonstate.edu.
Yeah, okay.
Then it's /info center if you want to go directly to the Micronutrient Information Center.
And you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness, and we're speaking on the phone with Balz, B-A-L-Z, Frey, F-R-E-I, today. He is the director of the Linus Pauling Institute, among many things. He's also a professor. We're talking about flawed, sort of a combination of your name and the name of the show, flawed vitamin research. We're going to take a brief musical break, and we're going to come right back. We will post the Linus Pauling Institute website on our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. So stay with us while we break. We'll be right back for more information on vitamin research. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett sitting by. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our over 500 archive shows, actually six, I think, by now, with our library card feature. Find information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and lots more, yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, you can reach us by email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. We're discussing flawed vitamin research with Dr. Balz Frei, B-A-L-Z, Frei, F-R-E-I. He is he's a distinguished professor of biochemistry and biophysics and director of the endowed chair of the Linus Pauling Institute at Oregon State University at Corvallis, Oregon. And we will have the website to get into the vitamin research on that website posted on our website. So where we left off, we've kind of covered all I can think of about vitamin C, but I think we ought to get into your paper that you wrote with Michaels.
Michaels, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And obviously a lot of this is sort of, if anyone was thinking clearly, that would have thought of this already, but they didn't. So there's a lot of problems with how research is conducted. And one of the first problems is they're coming up with cell cultures, mm-hmm. not a live body. And there's a whole complexity of interactions with metals and minerals. And
right.
So why don't you give us a quick summary of what's the problem with doing these cell culture research things?
Yeah, I think in general, you know, whatever method or model system you're using, if you are aware of the limitations and can kind of minimize artifacts, then you're probably doing much better than using these methods without understanding their limitations, which will affect your interpretation of the results very much. If you are not aware of the limitations, then your interpretation of the data may be wrong.
Which is what happens, of course.
Yeah. So for example, with cell culture, I mean, first of all, we use immortalized cells in cell culture systems, which is very different from primary cells. I mean, sometimes you use primary cells, which are cells directly from a human being, and then you put them into the petri dish. But most of the time, you're using cancer cells that can proliferate and stay alive forever. I mean, we have this classical case of HeLa cells that have been used for decades, and this is a cancer cell line. So you're mostly looking at cancer cells and not at normal primary cells. And you need to keep that in mind because cancer cells are different in their metabolism from primary cells. The other important consideration is, of course, you are taking these cells out of the body and you're putting them into an atmosphere that has 20% oxygen. In the body, in certain tissues, you may have much, much lower oxygen pressure, like, you know, a few percent. So if you are now exposing your cells to this very high concentration of oxygen, you are causing significant oxidative stress in these cells. And so they may adapt in certain ways to that high oxygen pressure, which does not reflect what's going on in the body. Now, with respect to vitamin C, it's a particularly big problem because every cell in your body has quite high concentrations of vitamin C. There is a transport mechanism that basically pumps vitamin C into your cells against the concentration gradient. So you have millimolar concentrations of vitamin C in your cells, which is very, very high. Now, in cell culture, you lose all that vitamin C, and if you do not provide enough vitamin C in your cell culture medium, your cells are going to be vitamin C deficient. So you're looking at scorbutic cells, and 99% of all cell culture studies that are done with cells that don't have any vitamin C in there. So if you want to study oxidative stress or you want to study vitamin C, that's a huge problem. And so, again, these are very important limitations that you need to be aware of when doing cell culture studies. And if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to misinterpret your results.
Well, and indeed, even though human beings don't, domesticated animals and human beings don't make vitamin C in their bodies anymore, what you point out is that even people in a deficiency condition have some vitamin C in their cells, unlike these cancer cells. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, so even in animals that make their vitamin C, they only make it in the liver and in the kidney. All the other cells of the body need to take it up from the bloodstream. Okay, so that's the same for humans, but instead of getting it from the liver or the kidney, we get it from the diet.
Yep.
And the fact that we have all these proteins that pump vitamin C into cells, they're called sodium-dependent vitamin C transporter 1 and 2, that tells you something about the very important role that vitamin C plays in each and every cell of your body. Because Mother Nature wouldn't pump vitamin C into your cells just because it's fun or because, you know, there is no purpose behind it. No, that's very specific. You synthesize this protein. It requires a lot of energy to make this protein that then pumps vitamin C into these cells. So if you look at cells in the petri dish that don't have any vitamin C inside these cells because you're not providing enough vitamin C in your medium, you're looking at a highly unphysiological situation.
Well, and then, you know, so fine, we'll use rats. We'll use rats and mice, and the problem is that, oh, well, they actually make vitamin C in their bodies. Okay, well, we'll use genetically altered animals.
Right.
Instead of wild types, and then that doesn't work for some other reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, these rats and mice, which all make their own vitamin C, they don't need to take up the vitamin C from their diet. So they don't have the same uptake mechanisms in their GI tract for vitamin C. They may actually have no vitamin C transporter in their GI tract, again, because why would they? They don't need to take it up. They make it themselves. And so even if you knock out the gene that makes vitamin C in mice, they still are different in terms of their vitamin C metabolism. One important consideration is that they are not taking vitamin C up from the diet very effectively. So you can knock out that gene and shut down endogenous synthesis, but that doesn't make it a vitamin C dependent animal like we humans are.
Uh-oh.
The best way to study what's going on in humans is to study it in humans.
Think of that, yes.
Yeah, what a surprise.
And the reason they're not doing that is?
Well, because it's not as trivial as you would think. And this goes back to this issue of doing human studies with nutrients as opposed to pharmaceutical drugs. And that's the whole focus of this paper that we are discussing here today. So in general, you know, the principles of evidence-based medicine are very different from evidence-based nutrition. But what we are doing, or what the medical community in particular is doing, is look at how they run these randomized controlled trials with pharmaceutical drugs and then use that exact same model to study vitamins and other dietary supplements. And that just doesn't work. First of all, pharmaceutical drugs are metabolized very differently than vitamins. As I just told you, vitamins are required for life. They are absorbed from the diet, and they are taken up into your tissues. Often they are pumped into tissues against a concentration gradient. So the body needs these vitamins. There are uptake mechanisms. There are mechanisms of distributing these vitamins among your tissues and among all your cells. Now, the opposite is true for pharmaceutical drugs, which are all so-called xenobiotics. These are compounds that the body doesn't usually see. And in fact, the body doesn't want to accumulate these pharmaceutical drugs in large concentrations.
There's some expensive urine.
Yeah, there is expensive urine. That's absolutely right. So what the body does with pharmaceutical drugs is some of it make it into the system, but once they're in the system, they are extensively modified so that they become more water-soluble and then can be excreted with the urine or with the bile as quickly as possible, because these are largely toxic compounds that the body doesn't usually see and doesn't want. So if you do a study with a pharmaceutical drug, you can give half of your population the drug, and the other population doesn't get the drug, they get a placebo. And then you look at the difference between your drug treatment versus the placebo group. Now, the same you can't really do with vitamins, because you have vitamins in your body, otherwise you wouldn't have survived. And the placebo group will also continue to get their vitamins from their diet, although usually not in, you know, adequate amounts, but they still have a certain background level of all these vitamins and essential nutrients in their body. So if you give your vitamin to your treatment group, but not to your placebo group still has that same vitamin present in their body. So you're only looking at a small difference, a group that has low levels versus a group that has high levels, which very severely affects the statistical power of your study. It's not an all or nothing situation like with the pharmaceutical drugs. It's not enough versus more that you are studying. Now, if you do that, you also need to make sure you give your vitamin to those who have very low levels to begin with. Because if you give your vitamin C to people who are already saturated with vitamin C, like people who take 500 milligrams a day, then you won't see an effect if you add more vitamin C on top of that. But that's never done. They're just giving vitamin C to everybody, irrespective of their baseline vitamin C level. And so that's a fundamental flaw. It's like, you know, you do a trial with a statin to lower cholesterol, but you never measure cholesterol.
Yeah, I noticed
that. You don't do that. So if you want to study vitamin C, you need to measure it at baseline and then select those subjects who have low vitamin C level. Then you need to supplement them with vitamin C and measure vitamin C levels again to make sure the vitamin C levels actually increase. And then if you see an increase in your vitamin C levels, you may expect some additional health benefit. But if you never measure vitamin C, you're flying blindly and you don't know what you're doing, and you're going to misinterpret your results because you're saying, oh, I did give these subjects vitamin C and nothing happened. Well, maybe these subjects were the wrong subjects to study to begin with.
Well, you know, a very brave sociologist at Turlock University, Stephen Schollenthaler, did a almost 20-year study where he went to prisons and worked with violent offenders, and right. also went to elementary schools in lower economic areas.
Mm-hmm.
And first, he just removed junk food and colorings,
mm-hmm.
and violent behavior, and things changed, and people got better and calmer. And then he introduced a simple, uncolored, without additives, simple hypoallergenic multivitamin.
Mm-hmm.
And their IQs went up 40 points.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And his research has been totally ignored.
Yeah.
So
that's kind of how Linus Pauling started his work on vitamins. You know, he coined this term orthomolecular psychiatry.
Yeah. Yes.
Right? And it's basically orthomolecular means the right molecule at the right concentration. So he's referring here to natural substances and vitamins and nutritionally essential minerals. You need those in the right composition and in the right concentration at the right time of your life. And they have a huge impact on psychiatry, on brain function, on mental function. And, you know, now we find out they also have a lot of roles in chronic diseases. And it's absolutely important that you get your vitamins and minerals. So now this concept is called orthomolecular medicine, and that's exactly what we are studying here at the Linus Pauling Institute.
Well, and yes, and I've had the good fortune to be mentored by people who are involved in orthomolecular medicine.
Yeah.
So I am a believer.
Yeah.
I love what the late, oh God, my brain just went completely south on his name, Abraham Hoffer. before he passed away. One of his famous sayings was, "No one ever died of a deficiency of pharmaceuticals." No one ever did that happen. Just a reminder, you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I am on the phone with the director of the Linus Pauling Institute. He is also a biochemist and a biophysics professor. His name is Balz, B-A-L-Z, Frei, F-R-E-I. It's good you didn't go to elementary school in the United States with that name. Sorry.
Well, my real name is Balthazar.
Balthazar is more fun.
Which is one of the three kings in the wise men in the Bible.
Yes. Balthazar, I can't say it, but it's more fun.
Yeah.
It is more fun. Okay, well, now we have, there's still yet another problem here. So let's say, okay, let's have human subjects. Then we have the challenges of measuring levels. Mm-hmm. And this is also one of the things where people say, oh, well, it didn't work. Nothing happened. We gave them the vitamin C. So there's, you know, all that stuff we talked about individuals and how deficient they are. One of the things we discussed when we first talked is about how when somebody's had a really poor diet and is very nutrient deficient in general, to get them repleted, you need to take mega vitamin doses. And it may be for the rest of their lives because their tissues are so, I mean, they've already gotten sort of sick, so they're going to need more. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at healthy subjects, so-called healthy subjects, you know, doctors and nurses, we hope they're healthy.
Yeah,
usually not, I think, but you see something different. But then if you're measuring with blood, the storage of the serum is there's challenges with how you do that. There's all kinds of problems with this. So why don't you give us a little bit of an idea about that?
Yeah, that's, again, a particular problem with vitamin C because it's such a great antioxidant. It will also get oxidized quickly. That's the whole point, you know, that under conditions of oxidative stress, it can actually scavenge these free radicals and act as an antioxidant. And as we discussed, this will cause the oxidation of vitamin C. So if you don't store your plasma samples or your blood samples properly, it will get oxidized over time. And a lot of these epidemiological studies or randomized controlled trials, well, first of all, they never look at blood levels, but those that do look, and they're few and far between, they may store these samples for years and years and years before they actually do the analysis. And the reason for that is that they first want to do their study and then see who shows benefits or shows some changes based on your treatment. And then you go back to the original plasma samples that were stored at baseline to see whether there's a difference in those that showed benefits and those that didn't show benefits of your treatment. And so these samples may have sat in the minus 80 freezer for years and years, and your vitamin C levels are not going to be accurate, even if you store them at minus 80, because it gets slowly but steadily oxidized over time.
Well, and then the other thing is that, again, in the human body, if it does get oxidized, it gets repleted at some point a little bit
the
way. Plus, you're taking other antioxidants are getting into your diet and your vitamins, too.
But in blood, you don't have these antioxidants. Like glutathione in particular, there's very little glutathione in plasma. There's some in red blood cells, but not in plasma. So if you store the plasma, your vitamin C just gets oxidized and not being reduced back to the original vitamin C.
So there's all kinds of challenges with just testing blood levels.
Yeah, the other thing is, in general, for these randomized controlled trials, if you look at vitamins in general and vitamin or mineral supplements in prevention of chronic disease, you really have to do this for a long time, because if you want to have an impact on a chronic disease like heart disease or cancer that develops over decades, you need to supplement for decades in order to see an effect, because these chronic diseases develop very slowly.
Indeed.
And most of the trials that have been done with multivitamins are shorter than 5 years. In fact, you can count the multivitamin trials that have been done so far longer than 5 years on one hand. It's five. You know, five multivitamin trials have used longer than 5 years of supplementation. Everything else, you know, it's not conclusive. You don't really know, because you're not accumulating enough endpoints. So treatment versus prevention is very different. Also, of course, with respect to the time frame, and studying prevention takes a lot more time and takes a lot more money to do those trials compared to treatment trials.
Yeah, although I would also add to that that people, from my own experience in my practice, I see that people think of themselves as healthy, and then when you actually look at a health questionnaire, you realize they have all kinds of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So for many people, a multivitamin is going to be very, very, very low-dose vitamins, mm-hmm. and it may be too low mm-hmm. a dose for them. So indeed, it may not be doing
yeah.
magical things.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this brings up another important point. You know, as we discussed earlier, these vitamins and minerals have actually very well-known biological functions. In particular, they are required for certain proteins and enzymes, and there are thousands and thousands of enzymes in our body that require these vitamins and these minerals as their cofactors or the active factor in the active site of the enzyme. So, you know, the primary function of vitamins and minerals is really to maintain normal cell function, normal metabolism, normal growth and development. And quite often, these are the functions that are not being measured in these trials. They are looking at chronic disease only. They should also look at immune function. Is your immune system benefiting from your multivitamin supplement? What about energy metabolism? You know, you need all these B vitamins for converting food into energy. Do people who take multivitamins have more energy? You can measure that. Do they fatigue less? Do they have, you know, again, better immune function? Do they have better cognitive function?
Cardiovascular function and mood.
Cardiovascular function. You know, these are mm-hmm. issues related to optimum health or mm-hmm. optimum functioning of the body, mm-hmm. and that's really what vitamins and minerals do. Now, if you can prevent chronic disease on top of that, that's kind of the icing on the cake. And even for that, we have actually fairly good evidence from the few trials that have been done in a reasonable manner. For example, the Physician's Health Study 2, which is a randomized controlled trial with a multivitamin done over 12 years in 14,000 physicians, so a large number of subjects studied over a very long period of time. And those who took the multivitamin had a 8% reduced risk of total cancer. If you eliminated prostate cancer, which was half of the cancers in these physicians, then the benefit for the remaining cancer, all cancers without the prostate cancer, was a 12% reduction.
I'll take that. Of course,
yeah,
I don't have a prostate.
Take that any time, yeah. You know, what pharmaceutical drug is out there that can
right.
reduce your cancer risk by 12%?
Yeah.
And this was, you know, a randomized controlled trial with all its limitations. So if anything, you actually underestimate the benefit from the multivitamin because the way the whole trial is set up, as we discussed, is stacked against showing any effect of vitamins and minerals. Yet it showed a 12% reduction in cancer risk, excluding prostate cancer. It also showed a 9% reduction in cataract risk.
Mm-hmm.
So this is pretty strong evidence from the gold standard, at least in the community out there, the medical community out there, that these multivitamins actually do have an effect on chronic disease risk. And again, that to me is the icing on the cake. The primary role of vitamins is to provide optimum health
mm-hmm.
and optimum functioning of your body. And if you also get a risk reduction in cancer and cataract, I'll take that. And I think, you know, that is really then something that everybody should take. If we have something that can prevent cancer and can prevent cataract, it would be almost unethical to withhold such a wonder drug from the public.
Well, because we're bathed in capitalism in this part of the world, there are vitamin companies, God bless them, who are trying to get people to pay more money to get food-based vitamins. And what I tell people is that you eat food, so the vitamins themselves don't need to be made from food, and you will have much higher doses and much cleaner products if they are pharmaceutical grade, even though pharmaceutical companies are scurrilous and may be using some materials you would prefer not to. But in general, most of the research is done with pharmaceutical grade vitamins, and the research shows benefit. So would you agree?
Yeah, that's, well, not all studies do show benefits, even with pharmaceutical-grade vitamins. The problem is if you use natural food sources, it's very difficult to study the vitamins per se. I mean,
no, but what I'm saying is if you make a product where you're extracting vitamins from food, you're highly processing the food, and you're removing a very low dose of vitamins, much lower than the usual multivitamin. Otherwise, it's not really food-based.
Right, yeah,
okay.
Right.
Yeah.
That's correct.
And one last question about vitamin C. A lot of elderly patients have even subclinical iron overload. And with iron overload, you know, if you're anemic, you want vitamin C. You want to up your vitamin C because it helps you to absorb more iron. If you have iron overload, then you do worry about vitamin C. But as you pointed out, the vitamin C protects you from the oxidative stress of the iron. What about just taking the vitamin C away from meals?
To lower iron absorption?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could do that, but I think the iron, you know, it is important to have it together with vitamin C, otherwise your iron is not bioavailable. So you need to reduce the iron so it can be absorbed in your GI tract. And I'm not concerned about the pro-oxidant effect of vitamin C in vivo because studies, including some of our own, have shown that even in the presence of iron, vitamin C still acts as an antioxidant.
It protects, yeah.
Yeah, the overall effect is still a protective one.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay.
You know, it's very important for iron absorption. So some people may develop iron deficiency because they're not taking the iron together with vitamin C.
Right, just so, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
you cannot overload with iron because the iron absorption is very tightly regulated, but it has to be in the reduced form, and that's what vitamin C's role is. But just reducing all your iron with vitamin C doesn't mean you will be overloaded with iron.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're completely out of time, and
okay.
This has been absolutely thrilling. Could you give out the website for the Linus Pauling Institute one more time?
Yes, of course. It's lpi.oregonstate.edu. And then if you want to directly go to the Micronutrient Information Center, you just add after edu slash info center.
Okay. Dr. Balls Fry, Distinguished Professor of Biochemistry and Biophysics and Director of the Linus Pauling Institute. What a thrill to interview you. Thank you so much.
No, thank you very much for having me on the show.
My pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website for easier access to our shows with our library card. Find information about our book. Get a free stream of this week's show. It's all at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. Email us if you want to reach us, admin, @yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.